politician. Can you make a right decision for all of us? For all of us. Politician. Can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah. Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah, for all of us. You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk? Will you bring us comfort? Will you bring us comfort? You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk? Or will you bring us comfort? Or will you bring us comfort? Politician.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number three of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts and then get subsequently exterminated. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee. He is the Deepak Chopra of genocide. He's Deepop Chopra. Welcome.
That's hard introduction. So we were talking about the direct consequences of the global depopulation policy, the political consequences. Since we have them nicely itemized, and I mentioned that governments are illegitimate and that we have false democracies for one thing, as a result of the depopulation policy. Two, that we have the rule of law has been subverted, and there is structural violence on an unprecedented level. The third political consequence that I want to mention is the surveillance, censorship, and control society that has resulted from the need to cover up the truth and to continue the deception. Now, of course, now we live in the digital age, and we have the ability to spread information faster and cheaper than ever before. So we can communicate across boundaries, across the oceans, at a dime's notice, for no cost at all, just as we're doing right now, and with video. Now, in order for them to stifle the truth from coming to the surface at a time when we have this extraordinary ability to communicate, they have needed to put in place this system of surveillance, censorship, and control. That is why we see all of these intrusions on our privacy. We see all of these intrusions on the communication that happens digitally, electronically, and they're listening in on everything because they are paranoid that the truth is going to come out and that there's going to be a global revolt, that the anger is going to be so great that people will not understand, will not have the time to understand. They will just react from the gut to the bad news. And if people don't have the time to understand what has happened, why we're in this mess, and they react by starting to destroy, burning cars and destroy buildings, government buildings, and so on, if they lose control of society, it'll be impossible to regain it, because it will happen globally, because we are all at the receiving end of this policy. So that's why they have put together this system of surveillance, censorship, and control. They realize that this is coming to an end, but they need to maintain order until the depopulation policy can be retooled, until the covert methods can be abandoned and replaced by overt methods. And my guess is that the reason they're allowing me to speak and you to interview me is because we are the only ones who can tell the truth. So we are breaking the ice so that eventually they're going to, open the floodgates of the information highway. And before you know it, everybody in the media, everybody in the education system will be talking about this. Because only then can the population be educated at large, right? And there can be a change in policy. But right now, You know, we are at the forefront of this. We are at the forefront of educating the public. They're listening to what we're doing. They're gauging, you know, the success we're having. They're gauging the reaction of the audience. And I can guarantee you that the intelligence community knows more about me than I know about myself, probably. And they know more about you than you know about yourself. Why? Because we're so important. We're so extraordinarily important right now. We are at the forefront of change, of global change. If they see that we are successful in what we're doing, people are receptive to this, that people are willing to accept their responsibilities and do it so peacefully, right? Despite the difficult decisions that we're going to be asked, that we're going to be forced to make by circumstances, not by governments, by circumstances, they're gauging all of that. And if we're successful, you know, this is going to go faster and faster. And the faster we convert this from covert to overt methods, the fewer people will suffer. The greater our chances for a bright future. The less the damage that our children will inherit from these methods of control.
You reminded me there of you know, recruitment, how employers, you know, they'll go to recruitment agencies and whatnot. Had a meeting with one of these recruiters one time, and he says, don't make decisions when you're depressed, you know, especially about your employment and especially about your life, because you're not thinking clearly. And I remember one time when I went to work, I was looking after autistic children at the time, and I wasn't feeling very happy, and I was really upset, and just wanted to quit that day. And I just remembered what he said, you know, and I restrained myself. And I think this is precisely what needs to happen with everybody. Look, if you're hearing this information for the first time and it's depressing you and freaking you out and what have you, don't make important decisions in your life as yet until you have learned more, until you have processed the information. Okay, I know people who have only just woken up, experienced the same things as I did in the first year or two or three or however long it takes, where you go through that process of depression and then finally acceptance and then on through empowerment. You start making your decisions after you've gone through the trials of and tribulations, so that you actually know what you're dealing with, so that you can actually approach these challenges properly. Reserve judgment. Goodness, I define as the restraint of oneself from one's instincts in many cases. And evil, I define as the absolute lack of restraint from your morality.
Yes. How right you are, Vinny. I cannot even begin to express, you know, how much lies behind that that statement. How much evolution, you know, how much understanding, how much suffering, if you want. People cannot retrace that, you know, from the very few words, unless they go through this process themselves. This is a very painful process, a very long process. It really is a personal evolution from complete darkness to unbelievable light. At the end of the tunnel, that sense of empowerment is there waiting for us. And it is absolutely priceless, because for the first time, not only will you have a sense of empowerment, but you will know exactly how the world functions. You will understand why these seemingly bizarre policies, you know, are happening, why these seemingly ridiculous decisions are being made by our leadership. You will understand and you realize the bind they're in, the dilemmas they're in, and that change is coming. Change on an unprecedented level for the better, and the end result of this change that is just around the corner is going to be a tremendous, tremendously better society than we've ever had before. I'm 100% positive about that. I'm not at all negative about the future. The future is not bleak. There is absolutely every reason to be positive, because I know that we can do this. We can turn this around. If I can do it, this is my reasoning. If I can do it, coming out of nowhere, with absolutely out of complete ignorance, I had no clue at all how the world worked, even though I considered myself, you know, to be an open-minded person and paying attention to my environment and always asking questions. But until 2011, I had no clue how the world worked and what was behind all of the decision-making process, what was behind the international community and so on, and every, you know, conflict in the world and every decision at the high level. I had no clue. Now I know. I know better than many of the politicians in power what is happening. Why? Because I've had the time to analyze the situation, to understand it from the outside. But how? Not because I've had, you know, I've had access to secret information and documentation. No, because once you have a door, once a door opens to this knowledge, the knowledge of the matrix, if you want, right? You have time to explore it. You can simply reverse engineer the thought process and the decision-making process of the leadership simply by looking at it from the historical perspective, considering all the obstacles that they would have encountered and so on. So it's very easy to retrace this process, to reverse engineer policy, if you want. This is what I have been doing. I have been reverse engineering policy the way, you know, let's say, an engineer would take apart an engine made by the Japanese, and you know, they say now I'm going to take it apart and draw the schematics, and I'll be able to do the exact same thing, even though I didn't have that knowledge before. This is exactly what I've done, but I didn't do this with a mechanical thing. You know, I've done this with policy, with the history of our world since 1945. And it's relatively easy to do. I'm not a genius, and yes, I am a bright person, and I have you know, the skills necessary to look at history and the analytical skills and the curiosity, if you want, to find solutions to questions. But if I can do it, anybody can do it. I'm no Einstein. So there is definitely hope, and we're looking forward to some absolutely wonderful things, I think, in the next 10 years and beyond.
It's faith, I think, to a large degree, you know, having faith that things will be better, having faith in humanity and what have you. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to adopt and see many religious principles that I've observed to have inherent truth within them, and hence adopted those principles whilst discarding about 98% of the religion itself. And as a result, I think I've actually gained a spiritual awareness and a faith that has served me well, not a faith in my government, nor a faith in necessarily a higher spirit, but faith in myself and faith in humanity. And the good thing about faith is that it matters not how many people try to discourage you from having it, because it has a religious zealotry attached to it that cannot be overcome by oppression or depression.
Yes, it gives you an individual strength that is...
It's beyond yourself. It's beyond yourself, more or less.
Source is beyond. Yes, it's not rooted in society and in the opinion of others. It has a much deeper root than that.
Yeah, it's like in an example I use many times to illustrate this point is the POWs in Vietnam and their survival rates. They had a very, very low survival rate. Prisoners of war did, had they no faith in God. Yeah. Those who had extraordinarily high religious values, Christians and so on and so forth, invariably survived the camps because when they were locked alone in their cell with no hope of escape, they weren't alone and they weren't without hope.
And now, you know, I've experienced this personally because I have been imprisoned 6 times. And the last time I spent 9 months in jail, and I'm also now remembering, you know, my father's observations. My father, who was a medical doctor, and who took on the communists in Romania, he was in prison for 4.5 years, almost 5 years, and he said the exact same thing, that his cellmates who were religious, you know, they fared way better than anybody else because of the strength that the faith gave them. And I've had I not had this faith, you know, in humanity, as you say, Had I not had faith in myself and faith in the inherent goodness of humankind, I would have not come out of this unscathed. You know, I would have long fallen apart, whether it's mentally or emotionally, in whatever way, because they've tried to undermine me in every possible way in order to deter me from following this to the end, right? But I've made such good use of all of these lessons that religions have to teach us, in order to get over this terrible time of imprisonment and dealing with this disappointing news, this terrible news. And I've even though I'm not religious and never considered myself religious, I've never realized that all of these values were deep within me, inculcated by the culture, not necessarily by my attendance to church, because I've never attended church, other than going to Christmas ceremonies and Easter. But they were there nevertheless. And for instance, one of the Christian lessons, and I've reached out not just to the lessons of Christianity, but also to the lessons of Buddhism, to the lessons of Hinduism, and so on. For instance, lessons of Christianity that have helped me through this. The notion of turning the other cheek, forgiving your enemy, loving your enemy, despite of what they have done to you. If I had not had these lessons, these wisdoms to reach out to, I would have self-destructed in jail simply because the anger that I felt at the authorities, right, of imprisoning me for nothing, for being a decent human being, basically, would have eaten me alive. And I would have come out of there, ready to kill, murder, and maim in retaliation. But these Christian values have allowed me to turn that anger into a constructive direction, and to use it, to understand and to retrace the path that the world has taken since 1945, and to turn that into love rather than hate. I could not have done this without the lessons of Christianity, and I'm deeply grateful for that. Mm. Another thing, had I not had yoga skills, which I've learned in India, and by practicing yoga, which is a Hindu offshoot, I would have not survived. Why? Because yoga has allowed me to go deep inside myself, especially during the 75-day hunger strike, which is the longest hunger strike in Canadian prison history that I have done. And I've done it as a 47-year-old. I'm not young anymore, right? It's a miracle I survived 75 days of hunger strike. And the only reason I survived that is because I could go into meditation, deep meditation, and I could calm myself and almost slow down the level of energy needed for my body to function, I guess. Somehow this happened, and I was meditating, for hours throughout the day during the hunger strike. 75 days, there have been 75 days of meditation, basically, of yoga. Had I not had that skill, that ability to go inside of myself and to find that peace, that serenity, which yoga and Hinduism has given to the world as a gift, I would have not survived. Certainly would have not survived 75 days of hunger strike. This is almost physically impossible, right? During those 75 days, for the audience who doesn't know, I've lost 55 kilograms, or 28% of my body weight. And I've lost that, in 75 days as a 47-year-old man. Well, people are not aware with what this actually means. This is an incredible thing. This is almost medically unexplainable. This has happened not because my physical strength is so extraordinary, even though I have, I'm a strong person, I'm a healthy person, but it's because I had this, I had the ability to reach into this fountain of strength, which is faith in something greater than ourselves, and faith in the goodness of mankind, and faith that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, and faith that I'm going to prevail, that I'm going to turn a global policy around, with the help of people like you, because I cannot do this alone. I can be a spark, as you are, a spark. But, if this spark has to spread, otherwise it is going nowhere. It's just going to die with us.
We are the spark, and the audience is the breeze that fans the flames. It may engulf the entire world in freedom and faith and love and honor and dignity and respect, moral obligations, that kind of thing. Now, I've got this idea that basically, for lack of a better term, I'm more or less a religious figure now. you know, I stand up against religions and what have you. And I remember as you were speaking, something that occurred to me. A pastor once told me, "Don't go to church. Jesus never went to church except to mess up the place."
Well, that's right, because, you know, we have an inherent need for reaching towards the divine, if you want, for the, you know, for higher ideals, and religion has nurtured them, has sort of shown the path, if you want, you know, they're like textbooks, you know, for following this path of inner discovery. But they're not absolutely necessary by any means. And I had this conversation, you know, in jail with the pastors, and because every now and then, once a week, we would have a visiting pastor to talk to us. And I was getting into huge arguments with him, saying that, you know, he was a Christian, and he said that the only way to God is through Christ. And I said, no, there are 7 billion people on earth, and there are 7 billion ways to God. And every one of us has to find his own way to God. No one religion monopolizes the key to the kingdom of God, the key to this ultimate knowledge of self and the greater universe. These are just, you know, they're just well-trodden avenues that opened by others. Religions provide, you know, an easier way to find your way, but you can find your own way.
Kind of like a road. The Romans built a whole lot of roads, and it made it very easy to find the way, but it also made it very easy for the Romans to project military dominance over your life.
Yes, everything's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Including fate. This is why it's being used and misused. Right?
It's being used as a weapon.
Yes.
Could you imagine the callous, malicious nature of a human being who would decide to use the best part of people's cells as a weapon?
But the same is happening not just with faith, not just with religion, but also with science. Science, scientific tools, scientific methods are being used to undermine our health, to undermine our existence. Mm. I mean, you know, this is the thing. Everything has this duality, this potential for good and evil. And the trick, if you want, the secret in life is to find that balance, you know, that perfect point of harmony between the two. And we have to find that ourselves. Nobody can find it for ourselves.
That's
just
right.
Like nobody else can chew your own food. You have to chew your own food.
And that reminded me of a microwave beams. One dude invented a microwave beam that you could shoot it at salt water and it would start boiling. And so he realized, oh my God, I can use salt water as fuel. And he made a car that ran on it, and it was running perfectly fine and well. And at the same time, the U.S. military was pioneering a form of microwave tank where you could shoot microwaves at the enemy soldiers, and they would explode from within.
Yeah, well, the perfect example is, you know, the nuclear energy. You can use it to produce energy to advance civilization and heat homes and so on, or you can use it for the ultimate destruction, you know, the nuclear annihilation of an atomic explosion. It's either way.
Incidentally, even when you try to use that nuclear energy for the good purposes, one tsunami can turn it into a bigger nuclear weapon than anything you can manufacture.
Yes, but, you know, life is difficult. We, throughout our existence, we've struggled against all odds, if you want, to make progress for civilization to advance. You know, it has taken the combined effort of billions of people before us and billions of people today. And we are all, but this is the thing, the human race, the human being is inherently good, and all of us aspire to have a positive influence in the world. It is just that circumstances sometimes do not provide us with the possibility to do good. We're sometimes forced, you know, cornered, if you want, to react in negative ways. And that is why it is so important that the system, especially this global system that is in the process of coming upon us, you know, as the form of government for the future. That is why it is so important that it is properly conceived, that we have a say in it, and that it embodies the best in us, that is to say, our highest common denominators, not forcing us to settle for our lowest common denominators, which is what is happening, right? Because of the difficulty of agreeing, you know, on a course of action, and the difficulty of implementing tough decisions, we have settled, or the international system that we have now has settled upon the lowest common denominators, and the global depopulation policy is the perfect embodiment of that, because it is the lowest of the low. And only we can turn that around. You know, our leaders cannot do that for us. They've tried their best, and this is all they could come up with. And now it is, if we want better, then we have to take control of this, and we have to show them that it is possible to do better. And the only way it is possible to do it better is if we all share responsibility. It's as simple as that, and as hard as that.
Well, the element that I think really ties into this is psychopathy. Psychopaths do not think like you or I. You kind of think, why would somebody do that? Why would somebody lie so terribly? Why would somebody rape and kill and murder and pillage and destroy and steal and all of that kind of stuff and not feel bad about it in any way, ever? Why would they always sabotage their competition in order to advance themselves forward? Why would they kill and torture little babies? Why would they wear a teenage girl's head as a hat as he drives through three states and what have you? Somebody with a conscience and any form of morality would not be capable of understanding that, because they're not insane psychopaths. Now, what I find very interesting is the American Medical Journal defined a psychopath as a person very nice and friendly and smiley when you first meet them, but ultimately has no depth to their character and doesn't give a frack about anybody but themselves.
No empathy.
And they tend to cluster, and these are the only two desires of psychopaths so far as I know, and it's power and control. All right, those are their two desires, and they fear two things: being exposed and being threatened by even worse psychopaths than themselves. Now, the American Medical Journal goes on to state that the likely industries where these people are to cluster in is the centers of power and control: business, entertainment, politics, law, medicine, and religion. What would you say, Kevin, are the institutions that have managed to implement this global control system, this global depopulation agenda, and all the world wars and all the international finance and everything thus far? Be all of those all racked together. And it becomes clear now why the world seems like such a crazy place. It's because crazy people are in charge of it.
And yet, the people who meet this description, this psychological description, are few and far between us. They're the exception, not the rule. The normal people are the overwhelming majority. Mm-hmm. And it is up to us, to the overwhelming majority of normal people, to take responsibility and to make sure that we not allow, psychopaths or those with such traits or psychopathic policies to dictate our life. Mm. And that is entirely in our hands, because let's face it, the few psychopaths that have made it to positions of power could very easily be disabled by us if we only stood up and took our civic duties seriously, and if we took responsibility seriously, and if we're willing to make sacrifices for the common good and not just for ourselves. It is all within our hands. If we allow ourselves to be victims of a few psychopaths, then we deserve to be victims of a few psychopaths, because simply we're not better. We don't deserve any better. Mm. And I'm very, of course, ever since I've started speaking, about these inconvenient truths, I've been very disappointed, of course, that people have not immediately come to the realization of the importance of what I'm talking about, that it is of existential importance to everybody, that there's absolutely nothing out there in the world that is more important. It's puzzled me that people haven't simply stopped everything they're doing to take this cause upon themselves and to change this immediately. It has been of a great befuddlement to me that these news have not spread like wildfire. That 2 years later, I'm still trying to gain momentum, if you want, and to create a tidal wave that will be irreversible.
You're never a prophet in your own home nor your own nation, are you?
Yes, that's true. It seems, at least among some people, it seems that they have a more difficulty to accept one of their own as doing something extraordinary than to accept that somebody far away is capable of something extraordinary.
I think that's because if it's one of your own that's doing something extraordinary, it makes you feel guilty because you know that you're capable and you're falling short yourself, and so therefore you need to tear down everybody around you that is putting you to shame.
Yes, I'm certain that you are right in your analysis. But nevertheless, we are all capable of extraordinary things, and this is the amazing thing is that now, perhaps for the first time in history, we're being called, we're being asked by circumstances to rise to the occasion and do extraordinary things. And if we don't, we're all screwed. We're being provided with the opportunity, but also with the duty, because there are no two ways about this. If we turn our back on this, we're all lost. That's the end of it. If we turn our back on this, it's the end of it, because the people in power, psychopaths or not, whether it's, they're doing these cruel things because they're psychopaths or because they're constrained by the inadequate tools that they have and by the necessity of reaching consensus among 7 billion people and imposing, decisions from the very top by a handful of people on 7 billion people. However you want to analyze this, from whatever angle you want to look at it, whether it's from the positive or the negative point of view, the point is that it can only be turned around if we take control, if we rise to the occasion and we do extraordinary things. And one of the extraordinary things that we have to do, that our generation has to do, is we have to marry, for the first time, we have to marry within us science and faith. In other words, we have to think, rationally, but yet have the courage that can only come from faith, the courage to take a leap of faith. And it's not called a leap of faith for nothing. It is called a leap of faith because we're going to the unknown. And unless we have that courage, that crazy courage that comes from faith, we're not going to be able to trust ourselves and to believe in ourselves to the degree that we feel we're capable of shaping global policy and of being in control of the world. Mm. We won't do that. It only comes from...
Oh, sorry, continue.
So we have to marry reason and faith. No other generation in the past has had to do that. There's always been a struggle, throughout history between reason and faith, if you want. During the Roman times, you could say that reason prevailed. During the medieval times, you could say that faith prevailed. But if one proceeds without the other, only disaster waits at the end of the road. We see what has happened, with the Inquisition throughout Europe. You could say that it's faith at its worst, or faith unrestrained by reason. Now we can see what reason, in the form of science, has done without faith. It has subjected us to population control methods, to poisoning, to eugenics, to genocide, society of absolute control, and so on. So unless we are capable and we succeed in marrying faith with reason, we're all lost. And this balance has come, from centuries of trial and error. This understanding, this wisdom, has come from centuries of trial and error. Now, for the first time, we understand that that our future cannot be bright, that it's not possible to be human and humane without being capable of marrying faith and reason, within our own consciences, within our own actions, because our own actions will dictate the ultimate outcome, the sum total of society. And if we behave, properly as individuals, and if we do our part, then the end effect, the sum total of our society is going to be good. If we don't, if we refrain from doing our part, if we hide, behind our walls, behind the walls of our own homes, and fail to do our duties towards society at large, then we're going to be all lost.
Yeah. Well, I think what's happening now as society is that we need to expel these things that we no longer want and just take a risk, you know? It's kind of like if you're really, really drunk and you can't find the light switch and you've got to go to the bathroom to take a wiki leak in pitch black darkness, you're just taking a leak of faith.
It's a good analogy. You're always very inventive in coming up with the great analogies. I wish I had your inventiveness.
I put the anal in analogy.
Okay, let me go back to the list. So I finished the political consequences, if you want, direct consequences of the global depopulation policy. Let me move on to the ethical. And the first one at the top of the list is that we have a culture of deception, dishonesty, and cruelty as a result of this. Now, whether they like it or not, governments nowadays have to lie to their people and to deceive them into believing this false reality, right? Which is an illusion manufactured to hide these dangerous truths of the depopulation policy. So you have lies built upon lies. We are told that fluoride is good for our teeth, that chemtrails are meant to slow down global warming, that the GMOs will increase yields and feed the starving, that plastic is safe, that flu vaccines will save the sick and the old from dying, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that 9/11 was the work of Islamic fundamentalists, that affluence stops overpopulation. All of these things are complete lies, so that they could proceed, you know, while distracting us, they could proceed with the plan. They could sort of force us towards this direction, which is our you know, the ultimate goals are fantastic. They're noble goals. Global peace and universal prosperity are noble goals. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the goals. It's just the methods, the methodology to reach these goals are wrong. They're completely wrong. So we have a culture of deception, dishonesty, and cruelty. That is one of the ethical consequences of this.
A culture of scumbaggery.
Scumbaggery, yes. That's another way of not putting it. And what else do we have? Another consequence is that we have a warped media, completely dysfunctional media, which instead of educating the public and informing the public, the mainstream media's role is to misinform and to indoctrinate. So deception, dissimulation have proliferated alongside this increasing monopolization of the media by a few giant corporations. And the reason they've monopolized the media in the hands of a few giant corporations is so that they could have ultimate control. They could have, you know, tight control of the message. If they can control the message, they can stifle the truth. And if they can stifle the truth, they can continue, you know, with these methods that are based on deception and lies. That is coming to an end. You know, it's coming to an end because of people like you, who have the courage to stand there and who you know, instead of going out and drinking and having fun, you know, you are spending your energy on educating the public at great risk to yourself. And of course, you know very well at the beginning, we've been ridiculed. We've been obviously shills have come from the woodworks, you know, to accuse us of this, that, and the other, to disillusion us, to frighten us, to bully us, and so on.
I'm not entirely certain if what I'm doing puts me at great risk. I think that doing nothing would put me and everybody at even greater risk.
This is the way I saw it, you know, and this is when I realized what is at stake. I realized that whether I do something or I do nothing, the risk is the same. At least if I do something, I have a chance of not only taking control of this and of having a say in the outcome, but at least I'm in control of my own destiny. At least I regain, you know, the dignity of man, dignity of life, and I'm not a slave to a system. I'm not a slave to, you know, other people's decisions.
It's exactly like at the very end of The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, where they've got bugger all army left or anything like that, but they have to march on the Black Gate in order to distract the armies of Sauron so that the Hobbit can have his chance to chuck the ring in the mountain, right? And the dwarf says, "Certainty of death, small chance of success. What are we waiting for?"
Yes. And also, what kind of man would I be if I don't defend my children, if I don't defend the integrity of my children's minds and bodies? What kind of man would I be if I didn't defend my family? I would be a rat, not a man. And it puzzles me that so many so-called men, you know, that men out there are not standing up and acting as men, and instead they're behaving as rats, you know, waiting for other men to fight the good fight so that they can have all the benefits, but without lifting a finger. And what this is, it has come to a point now that where, you know, we're all being tested. And if we don't rise to the occasion as men, as human beings, we're all going to fail, because this is not something that can be turned around by a single man. This is a global problem that can only be solved through global effort. A single man, you know, like you and I, despite our most valiant efforts and achieving extraordinary things, and, you know, fighting the system to break the ice, we can only take this so far. Without everybody standing up, nothing is going to happen.
The best we can hope to be is an example to others, you know.
Because I cannot moderate and regulate, you know, people's moral behavior and decisions in their lives. Everybody has to do that on their own, so that the end effect, the sum total of our society, is going to be positive, not negative. All we can do is, you know, show the way and inspire others. But if men don't have the courage and the integrity to stand up and defend their families and their children, then they don't deserve to make it into the future. That's the reality of it. Mm. And this is where, you know, you start to think like the depopulationists, because they are giving us the opportunity to rise to the occasion. But, you know, very few people are rising to the occasion. Very few people have the courage to face the facts. Very few people have the energy to follow the facts, their ultimate source, and so on. So, you know, we are being
reminded of... It reminds me of a couple of things the Founding Fathers were saying is if you give up your freedom for security, you lose both and deserve neither. What was the other one? In the beginning, a patriot is scorned, insulted, and cast out of his society. And only once his cause has proved successful do others join it, because then it costs nothing to be a patriot.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. No doubt. now, I don't want to go through the medical consequences, which are direct consequences, simply because they're quite well known. You know, irreversible infertility, general ill health, downgraded genetic and intellectual endowments, endemic mental and developmental illnesses, sexual confusion, and so on. We've talked these issues to death. They're out there, you know, for everybody to grasp, if only they want to. But I want to talk about the indirect consequences now, because the indirect consequences are not as clear, and people don't realize what is at stake unless they are introduced, you know, to these indirect consequences, and these consequences are explained to them. Now, going from a growing to a decreasing population causes economic havoc in liberal free market economies that are premised on continuous growth. Capitalism, as you well know, is premised on growth. Well, you cannot have growth in a decreasing population. And now that we have reached the fourth stage of the demographic transition, the populations have started to decrease throughout the Western world. Japan was the first, right? Germany, Italy. And now basically every European country now is decreasing in population. So one of the most obvious consequences of this is recession, deflation, chronic unemployment. So all of the economic ills that the governments now are fighting so hard to address. Well, a stable and especially a decreasing population brings about stagnation and respectively contraction in consumer spending, which in turn causes recession. And that if prolonged, if it goes on and on, it results in chronic unemployment, deflates the value of goods and services as there is more supply and demand, and you have a chain effect of a spiraling downward economic situation. And this is what is happening now. We see that, you know, throughout Europe, all of the social systems are collapsing. The economic symptoms that I described, you know, are the most acute in Japan, as would be expected, because they're the first to have reached this fourth stage of the demographic transition. And of course, Europe is right behind it. And before you know it, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand will enter the exact same deflationary spiral, recessionary spiral, chronic unemployment spiral. And that is going to be impossible to address until the population stabilizes.
Or unless the population gets orderly exterminated.
Well, yes, that's not going to happen. You know, there's no way they're going to succeed in that. So there is another unless. The other unless.
Are you sure? Because I've yes. seen a lot of biological nutrient technologies. There's something like 1,000 plus bioweapons labs in the United States. They've got the chemtrails and everything like that. If they wanted to wipe everybody out, they could do it without a moment's notice.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. They could do it. It is, you know, it's possible. They have the tools to do it. But nobody wants this outcome. You understand?
Unless they're psychopaths, insane psychopaths who have their finger on the trigger. This is what my concern is. I'm sorry. Yeah, continue.
The few psychopaths that are part of these inner circles. Are constrained by the others. Nobody has ultimate authority in today's system. There's a check of and balance of power. Politicians are constrained by bankers. Bankers are constrained by politicians. Politicians and bankers are constrained by policymakers and by technocrats and by experts in their various fields of knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is such a complex system. With so many layers of responsibility, that no single person has the authority or the ability, you know, to push the red button and terminate humanity. That's not going to happen. And even, let's say that we have, in the unlikely event that we have a group of psychopaths all having gained control of the ultimate control of the world, even they would realize that it would be to their own demise if they were to destroy the entire humanity. Psychopaths have to be able to benefit from other people's labor and from other people's struggles and so on.
However, one of the elements of psychopathic mentality is a lack of an awareness for the consequences of their actions.
Well, I'd say more a lack of compassion, and empathy for the pain or suffering caused to others, but I'm sure that they would know their own interest. People who don't know their own interest simply do not survive. And the fact that we know our own interest has evolved, from a process of evolution. And those people who are most likely to know what their own interest is and to make the right decisions will survive into the future, and their genetic lines will prosper. Whereas the others, those who can't make these decisions, will go into oblivion. So I'm not concerned at all that a group of psychopaths is going to kill us all. No, I'm not. What I am concerned about is that they will, the international community will realize that they cannot. That all of these systems and measures in place right now to stop the population explosion, to peak at 9 billion by 2040 or 2050, which is the goal now, the second phase of the population policy. If they realize that they cannot succeed that in doing that, in accomplishing this goal, and they see that our food supplies are dwindling and that we're approaching such a critical situation that unless they do something preemptively, we're all going to be dead, or they're going to lose control, there's going to be havoc, or there's going to be a run for whatever little food there is left, then they might have some conceivably a plan B where they would preemptively call a certain percentage of the population in order to prevent this collapse from dire necessity. That's conceivable. I'm not saying it is impossible, but even then, I believe that before we come to such dire point, we will have long succeeded in turning this around by simply educating the public and by simply realizing that we're all in this together. and that concerted action is necessary, and is necessary from the bottom up, coordinated at the same time with action from the top down. I think we've already broken the ice. We've already done, you know, the most important part. That is to say, we have come to this realization, and now it's just a matter of spreading this wisdom, you know, to everybody else, so that everybody else can come to this realization. And I think that is a doable thing. We can accomplish this, but we won't come to we won't give the authorities the opportunity to resort to Plan B, that is, to the desperate plan of preempting a societal or civilizational collapse.
As we mentioned in the previous segment about how desperate times call for desperate measures, I have my reservations about what it is that I'm doing trying to wake people up. I mean, we've talked much during this broadcast about unintended consequences. Yes. What if what we are doing right now actually winds up in future being found out to be very detrimental to the entire human race? What if we're unwittingly, unknowingly, through trying to do good, actually accomplishing even worse things?
And that is exactly what has happened. We've come to the understanding that by trying to do something, you know, good for humanity, but in secret, through, you know, deceptive methods, we've done tremendous damage to the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity. This, we've already come to that realization. That's why we're allowed to speak now. But this is one of the intended consequences. And I've just lost you here. Oh, there we go. You're back. You know, this is a fluid situation, and people are continuously analyzing what is the best way and sort of readjusting, you know, the direction of this policy. Now we're going through a complete turn of the ship. I believe that the decision has already been made. That is, they want a change from covert to overt methods of population control. They realize that it's necessary, that there's no other way, right? So the decision having been made, now it's just a matter of turning the ship around. That is to say, they have to retool, you know, to redirect this huge infrastructure that has been put in place for the past 68 years to accomplish now these goals through a different methodology. This is not an easy task. This is going to take time. And plus, they're also constrained by the fact that they have to do this gradually to allow people, you know, the time to get over the anger, to get through the process of reaching, you know, the point of empowerment through this knowledge, because that takes time. Instead of, you know, overreacting and going on a rampage, on a destructive spree of rage.
Mm. A new religion has popped up. It's called the New Age Religion, whose principal ideology is solipsism. Nothing is real. Nothing exists. There's no objective truth. There's no good. There's no evil. And ultimate acceptance of everything around you is simply an experience, and never, ever trying to change things for the better because you believe that you can't, that nothing is real, right?
That's just simply, you know, people who are demoralized and who just have thrown their hands into the air and said, there's nothing I can do about this, you know, and just forget about it.
I give up. I'm going to be New Age now.
Yes. This is the give up crowd, right? I don't belong to the give up crowd, never will. Because if you come to that point, then what's the point of living? Then you might as well put a bullet in your head and just you know, stop consuming precious resources. If you come,
do you believe that all of these people? Remember how we talked about faith and how you learned a lot of lessons about it while you were incarcerated. Do you believe that all of these people who believe in that solipsistic viewpoint have no faith? That when the chips are down for them, they will be the one that dies in captivity.
Yeah, I'm certain that you know, that's one of the things that they lack. But the faith is something; it's not something that you cannot get. You can nurture that, right? And oftentimes you find faith in the most dire circumstances, when there's nothing else left to reach for. That's when you find faith. When you come to a point where, you know, you can no longer rely on materialism, you can no longer rely on the system, or on others, you know, around you. So then you reach to faith. It's the last straw, if you want. So oftentimes we find faith in the least likely places or in the most unpropitious places, which is why my faith was strengthened, you know, in jail. And you'll find that, you know, anybody who has spent time in prison, they'll tell you that everybody finds God in prison. It's true. Everybody finds God in prison. It's
not a choice. It's a lack of options.
Yes, it's a lack of options. And it gives you such tremendous strength, you know, and tremendous hope when there's none to be had. And there's a lot to be said for that.
All right.
The unintended consequences. I mean, we're running out of time. How much time do we have left anyway?
A couple of minutes. We can go as long as you like, but wrapping it up fairly soon would be a good idea.
I'm just going to mention them quickly then without elaborating. So universal loss of freedom and a global police state. This is one of the unintended consequences. It's not because it was planned that way. You know, having had to cover up the lie and pursue this plan, you know, despite popular resistance to it, they have imposed basically police state controls. That's one of the unintended consequences. Countries as prisons, or this concentration camp mentality has evolved now. Why? Because they're so paranoid about losing control that you know they in order to keep control, they have to consider countries, you know, like basically major. Huge prisons and treat, you know, citizens like prisoners, if you want, by curtailing our rights so that we don't go overboard. One of the long-term consequences of this, which is, you know, looking generations into the future, is that if this continues, there's going to be a devolution or a splicing of the species. That is, it's, you know, the people who are able to protect themselves, the insiders of this global policy, they will have, you know, good health and an unadulterated mind, so their offspring are going to be continue, you know, on this path of evolution. They're going to be smarter and, you know, taller and better. Whereas the rest of us who are subjected to these poisons in the environment for generations, over multiple generations, are going to devolve into a retarded and a feeble human race. And this was foreseen by an evolutionary scientist, and I forget his name right now, but he published an article about that. But of course, I think long before we come to that, the so-called enfeebled ones, or the ones in the majority exposed to population control methods, will simply not be able to procreate. They won't even have any offspring, you know, enfeebled or not.
You know, what you're telling me there is almost word for word precisely the goal of hardcore eugenicists.
Yeah, they want to make eugenics a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, by lowering the genetic and intellectual standards of a great proportion of the population, they'll say that they'll be able to justify to themselves, you know, the ultimate annihilation of this segment of society by saying, well, look, they are almost subhuman. You know, why would you want them to survive into the future? Yeah. They're just a burden on society, right? They're not capable of civilized behavior. They don't have the mental aptitude to master, you know, the scientific and technological tools necessary for a modern society. So it's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, they lower our intelligence and they say, you know, you're just not capable. You're not fit for modern living. You just, you know, you're a subhuman.
This is the law of nature, so I'm going to artificially impose it.
Yes. You can look at it that way.
And they call us retarded.
As I said, the plan has never been this, you know. This has not been driven by eugenic, now I'm convinced of that, has not been driven by, you know, hidden eugenic objectives. It's just that the methodology has allowed, you know, kind of eugenic trait or eugenic consequences to this sort of genocidal population control policy. But I'm not going to go any further into that, because I want to wrap it up by putting the global depopulation policy in the greater context of the globalization, or the you know, the decision at the end of the Second World War to create a peace globe that is where peace reigns supreme and affluence is universal. In order to do that, the international community has had to achieve three goals. One is economic integration. The other one is political centralization, and the third one is demographic transition. So the global depopulation policy is accomplishing this third goal, which is a demographic transition. Why? Because you cannot have exponential growth of the population on a limited planet with limited resources. Sooner or later, something's got to give, and you have to go in reverse in order to live within the means of the planet, within the existing natural resources. It's very simple. It doesn't take, a genius to realize that. And history has had offers, multiple examples where civilizations, minor civilizations like the Mycenaeans and the people on Easter Island, have outgrown their resources and have died out. Or at least their civilization came to a collapse. But the other two goals, economic integration and political centralization, are part and parcel of this this positive plan, this noble plan to unite the world in common purpose. And of course, economic integration cannot happen without bringing the global population to a similar standard of living, similar income. So they're aiming now towards what I call a zone of convergence. That is to say, they want the rich world to lower their standard of living and their consumption level. So they're impoverishing the rich world, if you want.
With the exception of the super rich population. Well,
I explained that why that is necessary, why they're concentrating money in very few hands. Because by concentrating money in very few hands, those billionaires can take that capital and shift it from the developed world to the developing world in productive facilities, manufacturing, and so on. So they're shifting capital, know-how, and productive facilities to the developing world, and in so doing, they're impoverishing or bringing down the standard of living in the developed world, and while raising the standard of living in the developing world. So they're achieving this point of convergence. Like, we're going down, and the poor are going up, so that we're going to come together eventually.
And we'll all meet together at the very bottom with the elite on the top, who don't have to give up anything.
There's no doubt, and now we're going towards the bottom. That is to say, we're all getting poor. Why? Because we have to share, our limited resources among 7 billion people. So we're now sharing, a decreasing pie. Once the population stops growing and it starts shrinking, we are going to be sharing an increasing pie. So the sharing is going to be that much easier. So this is the goal of economic integration. But the second goal, the political centralization, is necessary because we're moving now from a world which is ordered according to national interests and national institutions towards a world that is ordered toward, according to international or global interests and global institutions. This is the greatest transition in human history. We're now moving towards the greatest social organization or social construct in human history. For the first time in human history, we are encompassing the entire world. We're uniting across continental frontiers, across man-made boundaries and natural boundaries. Now, this is a goal that has existed in the human race for thousands of years, and others have attempted to accomplish it in the past through military conquest, and they have failed. And now this is being done through monetary coercion. This is why the power of money is so important. This is why banks and the economic system has such an important role to play, and this is why we all have loved to hate it, right? Because all of the goals towards unity, towards economic unity, political unity, and so forth, they're being pursued through the power of money, through economic manipulations. We all have to pay a price for this, right? We all have to give and take. And nobody is coming out at the top. And nobody can have only benefits from this or expect only benefits. We're all asked or actually forced to make tremendous sacrifices. But why? Because the ultimate goal is fantastic. There's going to be a world united, a world where, there are no boundaries, a world where, our children can pick up their bags and go and work and live anywhere on Earth, a world where the resources of the Earth are distributed relatively equally, where there is no conflict between nations because there are no nations, where, every kind of interaction, every kind of problem is solved peacefully through dialogue and not through the use of military force. So all of these goals, the ultimate goal is fantastic. But we have to abandon, our old loyalties, loyalty to country, to nation, to race, to religion, and so on. We have to transcend these old loyalties, and we have to expand our horizons to embrace, you know, this greater world that has such diversity. And we're the first generation to be asked to do that, which requires tremendous understanding, if you want, and a tremendous sort of personal evolution.
Indeed. Okay, Kevin Galilee, ladies and gentlemen, you can Google him and you can find his books. What was the name of your books again, sorry?
My last book is called Killing Us Softly, Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy. And my next book, which is probably going to be finished in about 3 or 4 months, will be called Survival or Extinction. And I think this will be the most important work I will have done in my life, in addition to my own principles. The own principles I've already published 2 years ago. And as I said, now they are the stated policy of the Civil Rights Party of Canada. So they're going to find a practical application, hopefully, in the near future here within Canada as part of our political system.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And lastly, just to reiterate, this is a 100% listener-supported broadcast. So if you would go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and subscribe and donate regularly, because I will be bringing on guests regularly who will enlighten you, who will help you, who will advance humanity down a better path. If you support me, you support all of them by proxy. How much do you value the future of humanity? Is it $5 a month? Hopefully. At least that. We'll see you again sometime, folks. Thank you very much. The only exception. You are the only exception.